You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Yeah, it's easy to assume that what is left in the final printed version of the Declaration is the sum total of all of the conversations that had been happening in Congress. But I think there were certainly other things that were discussed that did not make it into the list of grievances or that did not become part of this conversation about what independence means. The Declaration could have been much shorter. It also could have been much longer. It ended up at about 1,300 words.
Hello, and welcome to episode 415 of Ben Franklin's World, the podcast dedicated to helping you learn more about how the people and events of our early American past have shaped the present-day world we live in. And I'm your host, Liz Covart. When you picture the Declaration of Independence, what comes to mind? Most people envision a single iconic document, parchment, signatures, maybe even a scene from National Treasure. But what if I told you the Declaration of Independence isn't just one document, but many documents? And that each version of the Declaration tells a different story. A story not just about American independence, but about the people who printed, read, preserved, and even rewrote the Declaration. Emily Sneff is one of the leading experts on the Declaration of Independence. She has spent more than a decade researching the origins of the Declaration and its ideas and its different copies. She's the former research manager of the Declaration Resources Project at Harvard, a consulting curator for Revolution 250 exhibits at the Museum of the American Revolution and the American Philosophical Society, and I'm proud to say, she was our very first intern here at Ben Franklin's World. Now, during our exploration of the Declaration of Independence, Emily reveals why there isn't one definitive version of the Declaration of Independence and why that matters. How people in 1776 actually engaged with the Declaration, from public readings to personal annotations on copies of the document, and how generations of Americans, from abolitionists to suffragists, have interpreted the Declaration's promise of equality and liberty. Plus, you'll also hear Emily answer the questions that you submitted about the United States' most famous founding document. But first, there are some exciting announcements on the way. I've been working behind the scenes to create something new for you that will launch later this summer. And I've been working on a partnership that I think will help ensure the long-term success and sustainability of this podcast. Now, if you'd like to be the first to find out about these exciting announcements, sign up for the Ben Franklin's World newsletter, benfranklinsworld.com/newsletter. Plus, when you sign up, you'll receive a resource that you've been asking for, a reading list about the American Revolution. So to be the first to find out about our exciting announcements and receive your free reading list, sign up for the newsletter at benfranklinsworld.com/newsletter. All right, are you ready to investigate the Declaration of Independence and get your questions about that document answered? Let's go meet our guest historian. Our guest is a historian of early America and a leading expert on the Declaration of Independence. She's a consulting curator for museum exhibitions planned for the 250th anniversary of the Declaration in 2026 at the Museum of the American Revolution, the American Philosophical Society, and Historic Trap, which is in Pennsylvania. She's also worked behind the scenes here at Ben Franklin's World, first in helping us plan episode 141, A Declaration in Draft, and later as our very first Omohundro Institute intern. Welcome back to Ben Franklin's World, Emily Sneff.
Thank you, Liz. I'm so glad to be here.
And we're so grateful to have you back, Emily. Thank you for joining us. Now, we know we're going to have a great conversation about the Declaration of Independence. And I think we should start with the fact that you're one of the leading experts on the Declaration of Independence. How did your interest and expertise come about? What interests you about the Declaration of Independence? And how did you pursue your study in this area?
It's a good question. I, at this point, have been working on the Declaration in one way or another for 10 years. But I started out actually as a medieval historian, interested in museum studies. And I kind of backed my way into early American history, having never studied it formally, ended up doing research on a bust of Thomas Jefferson as sort of a piece of sculpture, not something about a founding father, and then ended up studying the Declaration more closely and kind of realizing that there are so many copies of the Declaration that were produced in 1776. And as someone who grew up outside of Philadelphia, I had never really thought too much about the founding of the United States or the Declaration of Independence. And once I started to, I realized that there's quite a bit of history and unanswered questions still to explore about 1776 and the founding of the United States. So that has captured my attention for all these years, and now we're approaching the semi-quincentennial.
And you also spent many years working with the Declaration Resources Project, which is where we met and planned episode 141, A Declaration in Draft Together. So could you tell us a bit more about that project and your work on the Declaration there?
The Declaration Resources Project was part of Danielle Allen's civic education initiative at Harvard. In my role as research manager for the project, I focused on both answering questions about the Declaration of Independence from a sort of historical research perspective, and also from a civic education perspective, thinking about how can people from K-12 all the way through adults best engage with the Declaration of Independence. So it was really important work at that time. And then I went to graduate school, and now I'm still doing research that I started doing at the Declaration Resources Project. And it's just taking the form of my book and museum exhibitions and everything else that is coming in 2026.
So Emily, for those of us who may be thinking, okay, the Declaration of Independence, it's a really famous document, but it's one document, and it's a really well-studied document. How many questions are really left to be discovered about the Declaration?
There are a lot of questions still. And in part, it's the fault of Thomas Jefferson and John Adams and the other men who were involved in declaring independence, because they did not keep as detailed records as we would hope for such a momentous occasion. I always kind of revert back to remembering that they were extremely busy, so I can't fault them too much. But there's still quite a bit that we don't know, or that we can only guess about the timing of independence, the drafting of the Declaration of Independence, not to mention all of the people involved in the process of declaring independence, only a handful of whom are named.
Now, you said one of the reasons that we have so many questions left to answer about the Declaration is the fact that Congress didn't keep great records of what they were saying and what they were doing. And as someone who has a complete set of the journals of Congress right behind them, I can attest that at times their minutes are really sparse. And that, of course, leaves us with wanting more information about what went on any given day that the Continental Congress met. Do you think that this sparse record keeping was because congressmen lacked the time to keep detailed records? Or do you think it was because they were so worried that if the revolution didn't pan out and they kept these detailed records, then the crown would actually use these records against them when it came time to punish them for their rebellious actions?
Absolutely. I think it's both. I think that every day in Congress, when they were meeting with everyone, not broken up into smaller committees, but when the whole group was together, they had a lot to take care of in a short amount of time. They were managing the war as well as opening all of these incoming correspondences from George Washington and other people, and thinking about independence and confederation and foreign treaties. So I can understand why the Secretary of Congress, Charles Thompson, would keep things fairly condensed. Even in his rough manuscript journals, there isn't a ton of detail. But yes, the other aspect is a certain level of secrecy was necessary for this process. And so we can get more detail from people's letters, delegates writing to their wives or to their friends, than we get in the journals of Congress, because that was the official record that would eventually be published and would be able to show who was proposing things, who was seconding things, who was signing their name to things. So yeah, I think it's a combination of both wanting to keep the proceedings of Congress contained within Independence Hall, and then also just having to take so many notes throughout the course of the day on so many different things. So it's a shame that we don't have the exact details of the meetings of the Committee of the Whole, which was the convening of all of the delegates to discuss the Declaration of Independence, as well as the vote for independence that happened before. That is completely secretive for good reason. So we have to kind of reconstruct the changes that were made to the Declaration and the conversations that must have taken place based on what the final Declaration of Independence looks like.
It's also a good reminder because we tend to really celebrate the Declaration and think about it in all these grand ways, especially every 4th of July. And yet we forget that the act of putting it together was actually a very dangerous activity.
It was. And it was something that took place in sort of spare hours of the day because the members of Congress had so much on their plates. They were also thinking about what was going on in their home colonies in terms of creating new constitutions. So in retrospect, if we romanticize the drafting of the Declaration of Independence too much, we're giving them more time and energy to spend on it than they actually had. And I think that helps to explain the timing of independence, as well as the language that is in the Declaration, the structure of it. You know, there wasn't a ton of time to sort of make revisions or really sit with the text and think about what it would mean to people 250 years on.
Well, today's episode is all about the questions that people ask Emily most about the Declaration of Independence, plus the questions that you've submitted for Emily to answer. So, Emily, what is the number one question that people ask you most about the Declaration of Independence?
I think the question that I get the most is about the Declaration of Independence. People ask me questions like, where is the Declaration of Independence? Who created the Declaration of Independence? As if there's only one authoritative copy. And in many cases, people are imagining the signed parchment that's in the National Archives as the Declaration of Independence. And for good reason, because that is protected in the rotunda of the archives. It sits alongside the Constitution. It's the subject of a lot of pop culture, including National Treasure. And so what I try to urge people to think about is that there isn't one copy of the Declaration of Independence. There are a multitude of copies that were produced in 1776, only a fraction of which survive. And so when we think about this period of time when the Declaration of Independence was first circulating, we have broadsides and newspapers and manuscripts. It means that there's so many other people involved in that story than just the men who signed the one parchment copy that's in our archives. So that's my starting point for when people ask me questions. Typically, it's either something that's focused on a specific one copy and that's it, or National Treasure questions, and both involve the parchment as sort of the defining copy of the Declaration. So just trying to broaden that out and think about copies that were created in other places and at other moments.
There are many copies of the Declaration of Independence, but is there one copy of the Declaration that is more official than the others, or do all of these different copies carry equal weight?
It's a good question, and I think there's a lot of different answers that you could give. The signed parchment is treated as sort of authority, even though there's typos in it, and it was created after July 4th, and it was signed beginning in August and continuing for months, possibly years afterwards. The Dunlap broadside, the first printing of the Declaration of Independence, that was authorized in a way by Congress because members of the drafting committee went to John Dunlap's printing office and supervised the process. So that was the first printing created on the night of July 4th, and that has a certain authority to it. There's also the manuscript journals of the Continental Congress, which, as we talked about, are not as complete as we would like them to be. But Charles Thompson transcribed the Declaration of Independence in those journals. So that's another sort of authority. And then if we look forward to January 1777, when Congress was meeting in Baltimore because it was no longer safe to be in Philadelphia, they had a printer named Mary Catherine Goddard create the first broadside that had the names of the men who had signed the parchment by that time. So this was the first time that the names were attached to the text and made public, in essence, by being sent to each of the states to form the foundation of their state archives. So those four copies have some degree of authority. And then beyond that, you have all sorts of printers and scribes and other folks who copied from those copies. So the sort of authorization or correctness changes as more and more people are involved in the process.
That's something that many of us may not think about when it comes to the Declaration. We tend to think there's one official copy in the National Archives, but it sounds like there were really multiple official copies, each with its own different story and each with its own different officialness. So, Emily, do you have one version or a couple of different versions where you really enjoy the story of that version of the Declaration?
I could list like 50 different copies of the Declaration that I really love the stories behind. including copies that no longer survive, that we have evidence that they existed, that a certain person owned that copy, and it no longer survives. But two that come to mind, one is now at the John Carter Brown Library in Rhode Island, and it was a broadside that was printed in Boston and purchased by a soldier named Daniel Gould. He had been a militiaman at Lexington and Concord, and he was in the Continental Army in the summer of 1776, and he purchased this broadside and he annotated it. He numbered the grievances against King George III, and he signed his name to it, right below John Hancock's name. So that's a fascinating story of someone engaging with the Declaration of Independence. Another copy that is particularly interesting to me, in part because of it being the lone survivor, is a broadside that was printed in Charleston, South Carolina, by a guy named Peter Timothy. And Charleston had just experienced a major battle, the Battle of Sullivan's Island, which was the inspiration for South Carolina's state flag. And basically, the Continental Army repelled the British and kept them from occupying the important southern port of Charleston. So as the news of independence was working its way south, the news of the victory at Sullivan's Island was working its way north. And so it took about a month for the Declaration of Independence to reach Charleston. And they had a day-long celebration, a public reading, and then they paraded down the street and had another public reading. They had a reading at the fort on Sullivan's Island. So there was this huge sense of celebration. And this broadside that was created by Peter Timothy, only one is known to survive. It's in the Gilder Lehrman collection. And Timothy later, when the British actually succeeded in taking the port of Charleston, he became a prisoner of war and was sent to a prison in Florida that was guarded by alligators. So it just shows you the perils of being a printer during the Revolutionary War. And it's remarkable that we have the one surviving copy of this broadside that we have, given what happens in Charleston after 1776.
Well, speaking of day-long celebrations to honor the Declaration of Independence and the United States becoming a nation, could you talk a little bit about why we celebrate Independence Day on the 4th of July and not maybe the 2nd or the 3rd or the 5th? What actually happened on the 4th of July?
So to give a very quick timeline, on June 7th, the Virginia delegation in Continental Congress proposes a Declaration of Independence, Articles of Confederation, and a plan for foreign treaties. And so that launches the debate about whether the time has come to declare independence. Congress decides to postpone that debate for 3 weeks to Monday, July 1st, which would be a nice round number for an Independence Day if they could agree to declare independence in one day. That's not what happens. So ultimately, on July 2nd, Congress decides to declare independence from Great Britain. And that news is printed in Philadelphia's evening paper that day, so it begins to spread. But they need a document that explains their decision. So during that three-week postponement, the drafting committee had been working on the Declaration of Independence. And on July 2nd, Congress turns its attention to the draft and starts editing the declaration, which they then approve on July 4th. So when the declaration is printed, first by John Dunlap and then by many other people, the date at the top is July 4th, 1776. So as the news spread, that date followed it. And that means that the next year, when July 4th came around, it's Independence Day. It's celebrated in different communities and by the Continental Congress. So even though the vote to actually declare independence took place on July 2nd, and I don't think John Adams was alone in thinking that would be the day that would be celebrated with pomp and parade and fireworks and everything that we expect for the 4th of July, it ends up being the 4th and not the 2nd.
Another question you must get asked a lot is how King George III found out about the Declaration of Independence. Did the Continental Congress dispatch him a copy? And if he did receive his own copy, do we know how he reacted to it?
Yeah, this is definitely one of my most asked questions, in part because of the sort of public memory of King George III, thinking of him as someone who was outraged at American independence, that he must have had some reaction. There's also an associated myth that John Hancock signed his name so big on the parchment that the king could read it without his glasses. There's no evidence to support that. And what it boils down to is all of the Continental Congress's previous petitions had been addressed to the king. but the Declaration of Independence is about the king. So he was not their audience, he was their subject. So they did not send a copy of the Declaration directly to the king. He found out through his Secretary of State for North America, Lord George Germain, who received multiple copies of the Declaration from different officers and royal governors that were in the then United States. So he probably found out sometime in August, the first or second week of August, 1776, and we don't know exactly how he reacted. The one reaction that we get comes at the end of October at the opening of Parliament, and the king gives a speech at the opening of Parliament as he typically did, and the language he uses in that speech, to me, suggests that he knows the language of the Declaration of Independence. He's not referring to it directly. He's still talking about the colonists and the rebels. But it seems as though he understands what was in the Declaration of Independence. There's also a direct response to the Declaration called an answer written by John Lind on behalf of the king's ministers. And that refutes every sentence of the Declaration. So we don't have a response directly from the king, but there's plenty of speculation about what the king would have thought about it. And I think we can all make our own assumptions as long as we're basing them in fact and not in the myth of John Hancock's signature or Congress sending a copy directly to the king.
That's really interesting because I don't think we normally think about the Declaration of Independence leaving North America and going out into the world, which means we aren't normally thinking about what the reaction of the world was to the Declaration of Independence. So, Emily, how did people in Great Britain react to the Declaration? I imagine that after they read about it in London papers, there must have been a fair number of newspaper articles and opinion pieces that then began to appear.
Yeah, what's interesting about the way that the Declaration spread is that there was a massive British fleet that was arriving at New York at the exact moment that Congress was declaring independence. And a British fleet has British mail ships. So that meant that even though Congress was trying to send the Declaration to potential allies like France and going through, you know, the Caribbean to do so, to try to avoid British interception, British mail ships brought copies of the Declaration directly to London. And so by mid-August 1776, the Declaration is in London newspapers. And there's quite a bit of commentary about what the Declaration of Independence means. And printers take different approaches to including it in their newspapers. Some printers print it in full, some censor the text, some excerpt the text. And then all of that is sort of fuel for European newspapers to copy. So Europe really learns the news of independence through the eyes of London printers. And that means that they're not getting the full picture that the Continental Congress would have hoped when they were sending out the Declaration into the world. So that sort of transmission through London is a really interesting and underexplored aspect of the Declaration's history.
Yeah, I find this really fascinating because we often think of the Declaration of Independence coming from the United States, but we don't often think about it as going out into the world arena and what reactions were to it. But there have been studies, like Lige Gould has shown this, right, that the founders wanted the United States to be a world player. They wanted this nation to be respected by other world powers. So do we know if Congress printed different editions of the Declaration in foreign languages so that they could call attention to what they were doing in the world? Did they print French versions for France or Dutch versions for the Netherlands?
I wish. That would make my job as a historian much easier. No, even though Thomas Jefferson and other members of the Continental Congress could have translated the Declaration very effectively into French, Congress didn't. They just had the English edition. So that meant when they sent a copy to their agent in France, Silas Deane, they were sending an English copy of the Declaration and expecting Deane to have it translated into French. So I wish there was more sort of thoughtfulness in the process, but that means that the translations of the Declaration really depend on the location of the translator and their goals. So in Pennsylvania, for example, there was a large German speaking and reading population in 1776. So the Declaration was immediately translated into German for that audience and printed in the Philadelphia biweekly German newspaper and also as a broadside, which suggests that the Declaration was read aloud in German in 1776. But then in Europe, the declaration was also translated into German in European newspapers, and the translation was just a literal word-for-word translation. And if you compare that to the translators in Philadelphia who were steeped in the language of revolution, it's a really poor translation. The men in Philadelphia did a much better job. So I think it would have been really interesting and important if Congress had devoted the time to translating the declaration in Philadelphia before sending it out into the world. Eventually, Benjamin Franklin makes sure that authoritative translations of the declaration start to spread through Europe to gain more allies. But in 1776, Congress fails on that point.
I know you're working on a book on this subject, so I don't want to steal thunder from that project because you know we're going to talk about it in the future. But this process of translation is fascinating because as someone who has studied Dutch and French, translating exactly verbatim from English into another foreign language doesn't always work. There could be idioms, those everyday phrases that make sense in one language, say in English, but have no meaning at all in French or Dutch or vice versa. So how could Americans like Benjamin Franklin be sure that those who spoke different languages were actually getting the full weight and meaning of the declaration from these translations?
That's the trick. You know, there's certain phrases in the declaration that you can kind of guarantee are going to be translated correctly. For example, free and independent states. That's a fairly straightforward phrase. But there are other words or sort of descriptions of events that are not as easily translated. For example, usurpations is a word that the French and German and Dutch translators have a real problem with. They don't really know what to do with it. So yeah, I think when Franklin gets to France later in 1776 and he starts thinking about propaganda and tools to use to put forward a specific image of the independent United States, part of that process involves thinking about those keywords from the Declaration and how to tell the story of American independence in a way that fits with the languages that he's looking at so that it's understandable for the reading European public as well as the courts of Europe.
Well, this is a great segue, the language of the Declaration, into our next section, which is really all about listener questions about the Declaration. But first, why don't we take a moment to thank our episode sponsor? Do you ever find yourself wanting to talk more about what you just heard on this show? Perhaps you have a burning follow-up question or your own time warp question that you'd love to ask and have others think through? Well, good news, there's a place for that. Come join me in the Ben Franklin's World listener community on Facebook. It's where people who love history and this podcast gather to dive deeper into episode topics, share thoughts and ideas, and connect with other curious minds who love early American history. It's a fun and welcoming space, so I'd love to have you there. Come join us at benfranklinsworld.com/Facebook. That's benfranklinsworld.com/Facebook. Come be a part of the conversation and bring your historical curiosity with you. Emily, Kristen would like to know more about the philosophical roots of the phrase, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and where Thomas Jefferson derived that phrasing. Could you tell us about the history of this famous phrase in the Declaration?
Sure. So this phrase is part of the very lengthy second sentence of the Declaration of Independence, which sets up the premise that people have rights and governments are supposed to protect those rights. And when a government fails to do so, then the people have the further right to alter or abolish that government. So the phrase says that all men are created equal and they have certain unalienable rights, including life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. So these are not the only rights that people have. These are just key rights that are enumerated in the Declaration. This phrasing has Enlightenment influence. If you look at John Locke's treatises, you can see life, liberty, and property. And also other Enlightenment authors are thinking about the concept of happiness, the pursuit of happiness. So Jefferson is pulling from a few different sort of Enlightenment texts and also just the revolutionary language that was starting to develop in the colonies. Pauline Mayer's book, American Scripture, is a great way of thinking about how many people at the local level were using the same kind of language to declare their intention to separate from Great Britain or just their need to consent to their government. So there's certainly a history behind this phrase. And I think the most asked question is why pursuit of happiness and not property? And the easy answer to that is slavery, that human beings are property at this time. So the pursuit of happiness gets around that question of slavery. I think it's a bit more complicated than that. But at the time Jefferson was thinking about the Declaration, he had been hoping to write a constitution for his home colony of Virginia. So that's where his mind is. He's really thinking about what Virginians' rights are. And then he pivots to thinking about what Americans' rights are. So there's a long history since 1776 of people using this phrase, as well as the premise that all men are created equal, to advocate for abolition or for women's rights, all sorts of things that Jefferson was not necessarily thinking about in 1776. So there's a sort of backward-facing history of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, looking back at the Enlightenment, and then also looking forward from 1776 to see how generations of Americans have reinterpreted that language.
And by way of a follow-up, Janet has a question about the interpretation of this language. She'd like to know how Americans have interpreted this phrase, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, over time, and how those interpretations have changed over time.
Yeah, over the course of the 19th century, you start to see the Declaration invoked during July 4th orations or other revolutionary movements within the United States. And the second sentence is key to that sort of interpretation over time. But really, this begins in 1776. The anti-slavery uses of the Declaration we can trace to Lemuel Haynes, who was a free Black soldier, later minister, who writes an essay called Liberty Further Extended. And he quotes this passage of the Declaration of Independence on the front page of that essay. So clearly, he's thinking about liberty in terms of the Declaration and its potential promise for future generations. I've seen a lot of different documents for the pursuit of women's rights, temperance, secession, all sorts of sort of descendant documents from the Declaration that either use this phrase in its entirety or tweak it a little bit to suit their purposes. And now I think life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness is so taken for granted by Americans, we don't even really remember what the original context was for it. So it's important to think back to that sentence in its entirety in 1776, and then also look forward to the ways that it has been used by anti-slavery advocates, women's rights advocates, Native American groups, all through the last 250 years.
Now, David is curious to know more about Thomas Jefferson's role as the drafter of the Declaration of Independence. He asks whether Jefferson was the true creator of the Declaration, or whether Jefferson served as more of the editor who helped put the drafting committee's ideas into a polished form.
Thomas Jefferson was the principal author of the Declaration. I think that's the best phrase to use, because Jefferson was the first to put words on paper. He was also the first editor of the Declaration, which is evidenced by his rough draft at the Library of Congress, which shows him crossing out words and changing the language, and then incorporating recommendations from John Adams and Benjamin Franklin. We don't know for sure what the other two members of the drafting committee, Roger Sherman and Robert R. Livingston, might have contributed to this editing process. But we know that most of the language and the structure of the Declaration was put on paper by Jefferson. And he also thought that the committee's version of the Declaration was superior to the final approved version of the Declaration. So I think it's appropriate to treat him as the principal author, but not the sole author, because the Declaration was the work of a committee, and then it was edited by all of the members of Congress. And so it's a document of compromise, and it's a document of sort of playing with the language, tweaking words, condensing grievances to cut down the length of it, all sorts of things that Jefferson did not agree with and was frustrated by. But we can certainly treat the Declaration of Independence as an example of a group project. There's always someone who carries the heaviest load on a group project, but it still reflects all of the other members. And that's where we get to compromises, including the grievance about the transatlantic slave trade, which Congress decided to cut.
We're glad you brought up the transatlantic slave trade, because Rosemary has a question about it. But before we dive into that topic, could you talk a little bit more about what you were saying, which is that Thomas Jefferson thought the committee's draft of the Declaration was superior to the one that Congress edited? Would you give us a brief overview of the different changes, or perhaps the major changes that occurred between the draft of the Declaration that the Committee of Five handed to Congress, and then the draft of the Declaration that emerged from these congressional debates?
Sure. The final approved Declaration of Independence keeps a lot of the language and really the structure that the drafting committee had agreed to. So it begins with a sort of preamble, which has the famous second sentence and sets up the list of grievances against King George III. And then the final paragraph of the declaration is the actual Declaration of Independence. It's where the transition from colonies dependent on King George III to free and independent United States takes place. So that structure did not change when Congress was debating the Declaration of Independence from July 2nd through July 4th. What Congress focused on was specific points about language and also just condensing the list of grievances against the king. So in the final paragraph of the declaration, Congress went back to the original proposal that Richard Henry Lee and the Virginia delegation had made on June 7th and incorporated some of that language into the final paragraph so that it reflected what they had voted on July 2nd. And then in the list of grievances, a few different grievances were either eliminated or condensed together because over the course of this long list, Jefferson's sort of initial language got more and more emotional, more heightened. Rob Parkinson's book, 13 Clocks, does a great job of laying all of this out. And so the last grievance in that original list attributed blame for the colonists' reliance on the transatlantic slave trade to King George III. Again, we don't have the specific records that lay out all of the conversations that took place, but I think it's safe to assume that delegates in Congress thought that that was a step too far, that if you included that grievance in the list, then all of the other grievances would lose their meaning. All of the grievances about taxation and trial without jury and all sorts of offenses that had taken place that they could trace to specific incidents would be undermined by this lengthy grievance, more than double the length of any other grievance, talking about the evils of the transatlantic slave trade. Importantly, it's not an anti-slavery statement in that grievance. It's just against the slave trade. That grievance is cut. And the story that comes down to us is that it was the Southern delegates who objected. Perhaps South Carolina in particular didn't want this grievance in the list. So what was in the draft declaration, the committee draft that they presented to Congress, that remains known only to the members of Congress and their wives and friends for 30 years. And then in 1806, George Wythe, who was one of the Virginia signers and a friend and mentor of Jefferson, he was murdered by his grandnephew, poisoned, but it took long enough for the poison to take effect that Wythe could write his grandnephew out of his will. And because Wythe died without an heir, because his heir had murdered him, his estate is sort of in chaos. And a local, very big Jefferson supporter, newspaper editor, seizes the opportunity to look through Wythe's papers, and he finds what we call a fair copy of the draft declaration, which was created in 1776 by Jefferson as sort of evidence that the committee draft was better than the final version. And he sent out these fair copies to his friends, including Richard Henry Lee and George Wythe, who weren't in Philadelphia for the debate about the Declaration of Independence. So this copy of what the committee draft looked like had been sitting in Wythe's personal papers for 30 years, and all of a sudden it's made public. So I think it's important as we use that cut grievance about the transatlantic slave trade as a teaching tool to talk about why slavery isn't in the Declaration of Independence, that we remember that for 30 years, no one knew that that was originally in the draft. And it's only when Jefferson is president that the general public realizes what could have been, what was in the committee draft versus what was in the final version.
Now, Rosemary is curious to know what prompted Jefferson to put that grievance about the international slave trade in the Declaration of Independence. Do we know why Jefferson included it?
It's a good question, and I think you could approach it from a few different angles. I think it's useful to think about what the Congress was preoccupied by in the summer of 1776, and Jefferson as a Virginian, what he was specifically thinking about. That's the explanation for the slur against Native Americans in what ended up being the final grievance in the list in the final approved copy of the Declaration. So I think the transatlantic slave trade is preoccupying the minds of Congress because they're thinking about the dangers of the Atlantic at this moment, the dangers of trade, and they're also thinking about what the economy of the United States is going to look like moving forward, right? They have a lot of things on their mind, including the management of the war. I think what Jefferson was not fully considering, and I don't know for sure if this was something that other members of Congress brought up to him or not, is that you can read the list of grievances in the Declaration of Independence as a list of what not to do, right? If these are all things that the king has done, then the opposite is what you can expect of the independent United States. So having a grievance talking about how this market where men are sold and, you know, the horrors of people being taken away from their homes and forced into labor. If you have that in the Declaration of Independence, then the assumption is that you will not allow that in the new independent United States. And that was a big order, right? That was something that would have required quite a bit of effort to stop the imports of enslaved laborers. We also have to remember that the Declaration was part of a trio of documents. They were thinking about independence, Confederation, and foreign treaties all at the same time. So this issue of the transatlantic slave trade would factor into the Articles of Confederation, as well as potential treaties with European powers. So it wasn't necessarily something that needed to be in the Declaration of Independence, but it does set up this sort of curious gap or almost a hypocrisy of why the members of Congress could say all men are created equal while allowing slavery and the transatlantic slave trade in particular to continue.
You mentioned the grievance about the international slave trade was dropped from the final declaration, likely because South Carolina protested it. But how do we know that was likely the case, given that, as we discussed, the journals of Congress are pretty sparse?
So that's based on Jefferson's recollections in his own sort of autobiographical writings, as well as some letters from delegates to Congress at the time. We know that Edward Rutledge of South Carolina did not think the time was right to declare independence, and he was trying to gather support on that front. But we're just kind of guessing based on the makeup of the delegations and also the fact that South Carolina had Charleston, which was this major port for incoming enslaved laborers. So we don't know for certain, and certainly that doesn't excuse New England's delegates who were representing colonies that were involved in the trade of enslaved laborers as well. But the evidence seems to point towards South Carolina as basing their support of independence on this particular point.
Yeah, I would imagine that delegates from New England, New York, Pennsylvania, and New Jersey would have had something to say about this grievance, because a lot of those colonies, as you said, were heavily involved in slavery and the slave trade. So is there any evidence of whether Northern delegates offered any debate on this subject, or that they were also equally as happy to see this grievance go?
It's hard to say. The one really interesting piece of evidence that we have actually comes from Abigail Adams. So it's believed that John Adams sent the committee draft in progress of the Declaration of Independence to Abigail. And when she receives the final Declaration of Independence in mid-July, she comments on it and says, you know, she's so glad that the Declaration of Independence has actually happened. But she notes that some of the more manly sentiments had been expunged from the Declaration. So that would seem to suggest that she, and by extension, John, would have been happier if that grievance had stayed in the Declaration. If we look from the other perspective, someone like Richard Henry Lee, who Jefferson sent a fair copy of the draft declaration to, he makes the point that the thing in itself is most important, that independence, making independence happen, that's the key. So regardless of what's actually in the Declaration of Independence, at least it exists. At least we've declared independence. And I think that there are a number of Northern delegates who would agree with that sentiment, people like Samuel Adams, who had been fighting for independence for a long time. Just the fact that they finally had the consent of their constituents and the, you know, support of all of the colonies to take this step. At that point, it kind of doesn't matter what's in the Declaration of Independence, because you just move forward as the independent United States. So for us, looking back on the Declaration as the founding document of the United States, generations of Americans have interrogated it much more than at the time the members of Congress really had the luxury to do.
Well, this part of our conversation speaks to the point that the founders were definitely thinking about slavery in 1776, because as you pointed out, Emily, they were also thinking about Confederation and treaties. And if you do look at John Dickinson's draft of the Articles of Confederation, just like Jefferson's draft of the Declaration, it contains a note that maybe we should think about doing away with slavery, given all of our talk about liberty and freedom. And I paraphrase that, but that was the general gist of Dickinson's note.
Yeah, it's easy to assume that what is left in the final printed version of the Declaration is the sum total of all of the conversations that had been happening in Congress. But I think there were certainly other things that were discussed that did not make it into the list of grievances or that did not become part of this conversation about what independence means. The declaration could have been much shorter. It also could have been much longer. It ended up at about 1,300 words. At that length, it's hard to tackle all of the different aspects of what the independent United States are going to look like or want to get away from under the rule of King George and his ministers. The second sentence in particular sets up a sort of promise that goes unfulfilled, to use Martin Luther King Jr.'s language, that this premise that all men are created equal immediately creates a conversation about, well, what does all men include? Who's included in the governed, the consent of the governed, who is part of that body? So I think that a long history of the Declaration of Independence helps us to tackle this question of slavery more so than we can actually find in the records of Congress, though they must have been discussing slavery both from a moral perspective as well as an economic perspective in 1776.
Well, we've been talking a lot about the ideas in the Declaration of Independence and the language used to express those ideas, but Travis has a question about the physicality of the document that is the Declaration of Independence. He wonders if there were any congressional discussions about where they should source the paper, the quill, and the ink used to draft the engrossed copy of the Declaration of Independence. And he also wonders what we know about who prepared the famous engrossed copy that we can now go and see at the National Archives of the United States.
It's a great question. I think to start, when we think about paper and ink, remembering that for a long time, the colonists imported paper from Europe. The paper industry starts outside of Philadelphia with the Rittenhouse family building their mill and creating paper here, but they were used to importing paper from Europe, especially Dutch-made paper. And so when the Declaration is printed by John Dunlap on the night of July 4th, he's using Dutch-made paper. It's high-quality paper. When other people in other cities and towns across the United States print the Declaration, they're using American-made paper that's made from rags, and it's not exactly white. It's pretty dingy-looking paper. So when you compare the Dunlap broadsides to other copies, you can really see the difference in the quality of the paper as well as the quality of the ink. Then for the parchment, the idea of that was that parchment as a substrate that you write on or print on is more durable than paper. Rag-made paper was just not meant to survive. We're lucky that we have the copies that we have from 1776. So they chose a piece of parchment that was well prepared. And then Timothy Matlack, who did some secretarial work for the Continental Congress, was the one who actually engrossed or wrote out the Declaration in a clean hand. He did make a few mistakes. If you look closely, he carroted in a few words. But otherwise, he did a good job of faithfully copying over what Congress had agreed to. And then the parchment left enough room at the bottom for the signatures, beginning with John Hancock and then each of the delegations signing north to south. Other members of Congress signed as they came back to Philadelphia. And it seems as though they all used the inkstand that was made by Philip Singh. So that's something that remains at Independence Hall. And it's a sort of relic of the signing, the Act of Independence, that has been used by other independence movements through time who have specifically come to Independence Hall to try to build a connection with that original creation of the Declaration. So I love studying the materiality of the Declaration, all of the different copies and types of copies that survive. The parchment in particular, it had a hard life after 1776. It was rolled up and carted around with Congress and then in the Secretary of State's office, and it took a long time for it to actually end up in the very secure and protected case that it's in at the National Archives. And the conservators at the National Archives have done so much work to try to understand the parchment, the ink, all of those physical aspects of the signed Declaration. So they've created a wonderful resource. The image of the signed parchment that's most familiar to us was actually an engraving that was created in 1823 by William Stone. And by that time, the parchment was already starting to fade. And John Quincy Adams, who was Secretary of State at the time, realized this and commissioned this engraving. So when you picture the signed parchment, you're actually picturing the 1823 engraving of it. But we're lucky to have that as an almost exact facsimile of what the parchment originally looked like.
Emily, What do you wish more people knew and understood about the Declaration of Independence?
I think for me as a historian, I wish that people knew more about the sort of expansive cast of characters that were involved in the process of declaring independence. There's so much focus on the signers as a block of men without realizing that the signers were never in the same room at the same time. They represent a mix of men who voted for independence, men who weren't even members of Congress at the time that independence was declared. And if we focus too much attention on them and their admirable act of signing the Declaration of Independence, risking their lives, fortunes, and sacred honor, we're missing out on all of the men and women who were involved in transmitting the Declaration and receiving that information. So I like to think about all the printers and postwriters and the people in the crowds hearing public readings, the translators, make it an international story. And that means that we have more examples of people that we can look to in 1776. It's not taking the founders off of their pedestal. It's just creating more connections. So for me, one particular person that I have looked to from 1776 that's not a part of the traditional story is a woman named Polly Palmer. John Adams was corresponding with her. They were old friends. And he sent her a copy of the Declaration, which to our knowledge no longer survives. But we have her reaction to it and how happy she was to receive this news. And she was a 30-year-old single woman in 1776. So for someone like me, that's a much more approachable person to look to than someone like John Adams. So I think just expanding our view of the people who matter to the story of independence, especially as we approach the semi-quincentennial, that's what I wish that people knew, taking their focus off of the signing and thinking about the Declaration of Independence's history as something much broader.
We should move into the time warp. This is the segment of the show where we ask you a hypothetical history question about what might have happened if something had occurred differently or if someone had acted differently. Emily, in your opinion, what might have happened if Congress had declared independence earlier in 1776 or later in 1776? So what if independence had not been declared in early July 1776?
Oh, I'm so happy to be in the time warp. I think this is a great question because we've been celebrating the 4th of July for so many generations that we take it for granted and we forget the exact timeline of independence and how things could have gone differently for a variety of reasons. If independence had been declared earlier in 1776, I think it would have been a more contested vote. There was a sense in Congress that this had to be a unanimous decision because otherwise you might risk certain colonies breaking away. You needed all of the colonies to be on board. So I think that's interesting to think about. Like, what if independence had been declared, but not unanimously? Later in 1776, even a week later in 1776, you're risking a potential change in public attitude because of this massive British fleet that was arriving at New York, including the King's Commissioners for Restoring Peace, the Howe brothers. And when Vice Admiral Richard Howe arrives, he regrets that he didn't get there before the Declaration of Independence. He thinks that he could have changed feelings about independence if he had been able to arrive and say that the king wants to restore peace and offer reconciliation. So I think that even in mid-July, if Congress had waited until then to declare independence, you would have had delegates in Congress that were questioning things because they wanted to see, well, what might the commissioners be able to do? Instead, when they show up, they disseminate their own declaration offering peace, but they send it to all the royal governors. And that's an immediate sign that they do not respect the fact that we have just declared independence. And so that really invigorates the Continental Congress. Later in 1776, gosh, who knows? I mean, Samuel Adams might have just passed out by then. He was so desperate for Congress to finally declare independence. And thinking about how the timing of independence impacts the Continental Army, many soldiers, including George Washington, reflect on the fact that the Declaration gives clarity to the soldiers, that now they understand they're fighting for the independent United States and not for reconciliation. So if that had happened later, who knows how all of the engagements of the fall and winter of 1776 might have gone. So it turns out that the timing of it worked out well, but in 1776, no one knew when independence was going to happen or what might happen next. So it's a really interesting time warp to think about.
Yeah. And I think it's a question that's going to help us be even more thoughtful for our 4th of July celebration and commemoration as we think about that this year.
Absolutely.
Now, Emily, you're at work on a new book about the Declaration of Independence. Would you give us a preview of this book and tell us when and where we can purchase it?
Sure. So my book is called When the Declaration of Independence Was News, and it will be coming out with Oxford University Press next spring. And it focuses on this time in 1776 when the Declaration was first circulating. So there's a sort of global transatlantic perspective on the news of independence, the timing of when people learned about the Declaration, how it was translated, how it was printed, and all of the ripple effects of that news. And this is the result of years of research, and it's my dissertation turned into a book, and I'm really excited for people to be able to read these stories and to think about what the Declaration meant to people 250 years ago.
Well, I'm a bit biased because Emily and I are in a writing group together, but her book is going to be amazing. It's beautifully written already, so I'm really looking forward to having the final version for all of us to have a chance to read it, check it out, and discuss it.
Yeah, I'm looking forward too.
Emily, if we have more questions about the Declaration of Independence or perhaps the exhibits you're working on for 2026, where's the best place for us to get in contact with you?
You can always go to emilysneff.com for the latest on my different projects and when I'll have book events coming up. I also launched a new project called Declaration Stories, which ties in to the book. And there are two newsletters that you can subscribe to. One begins this July, and it'll be a weekly newsletter every week focused on a different specific copy of the Declaration of Independence and the brief story behind it. And then in 2026, starting in January, I'll have a daily newsletter called News from 1776, which focuses on what was in Philadelphia newspapers on that particular day. So ranging from advertisements to international news to local news, giving you a sense of what did the Continental Congress know as they were deciding and then reacting to independence. I have three museum exhibitions that I'm working on. One in particular that's really exciting is at Historic Trap, which is outside of Philadelphia near where I grew up. I wanted to do something local for the 250th. And Historic Trap is sites that tell the stories of the Muhlenberg family, who were prominent Lutherans. And also Peter Muhlenberg was an officer in the Continental Army, and Frederick Muhlenberg was the first speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives. And his house, which survives, is in the process of being restored. We finally have some floors in there. We're working on the walls next. And that will be opening to the public for the first time next spring. So we're really excited. And I've been doing a lot of research on all of the different political positions that Frederick Muhlenberg held, as well as what it meant to be part of a German immigrant community as a leader in the new United States. That opens alongside the exhibit that I'm working on, which is called Window to Revolution. And that's all about Pennsylvania Germans' experience of the American Revolution. So we'll have Fraktur and firearms and pewter and all sorts of different objects that represent the specific experience of this community. And they're all centered around the manuscript journals of Henry Muhlenberg, who recorded what was happening in Trap in these pivotal years of the war. So we can really create an experience where people feel as if they step back in time and they understand really the refugee crisis and the environmental crisis that was caused by the war disrupting things in this area. So it's been really great to be a part of because I feel such a close local connection to Trap, and I'm Pennsylvania German myself. So that's been a really fun area of research to dive into now that the book is almost out of my hands and off to the copy editor.
Well, Emily Sneff, thank you so much for answering our questions about the Declaration of Independence and for helping us better understand this famous founding document.
I'm so glad. I'm always happy to answer questions about the Declaration of Independence, and it was really a joy to do so on Ben Franklin's World.
The Declaration of Independence is far more than a piece of parchment with faded writing that's locked in a glass case. As we heard from Emily Sneff, the Declaration of Independence is a living document with a complicated history. A history that's been shaped by hurried decisions, secret debates, international intrigue, and countless individuals who take us beyond the famous names of the signers. From John Adams's expectation that July 2nd would be our national holiday, to the forgotten broadsides read aloud in German or carried by soldiers like Daniel Gould, our conversation with Emily reminds us that the story of the United States' independence is far richer and more layered than we often assume. Our conversation also reminds us of the ongoing power of the Declaration's language, its promises, its omissions, and the debates it continues to spark. Whether it was interpreted by abolitionists, women's rights advocates, or modern citizens, the Declaration of Independence remains a touchstone for defining what it means to pursue freedom and equality in America and what it means to be a United States citizen. Look for more information about Emily, her forthcoming book, When the Declaration of Independence Was News, plus notes, links, and a transcript for everything we talked about today on the show notes page. BenFranklinsWorld.com/415. If you enjoyed today's episode, please share it with a friend who loves history or perhaps someone who might want to see the Declaration of Independence and the 4th of July in a new light. Remember, friends tell friends about their favorite podcasts. Production assistance for this podcast comes from Joseph Adelman, Karen Wolf, and Morgan McCullough. Breakmaster Cylinder composed our custom theme music. Ben Franklin's World is part of the Airwave Media Podcast Network. To discover and listen to their other podcasts, visit airwavemedia.com. Finally, after hearing today's conversation, how has your understanding of the Declaration of Independence changed? What do you think it means to live in a nation founded on a document that has many different versions, interpretations, and promises that are still being debated today? I'd love to know what you think. Liz at benfranklinsworld.com.